Weapons of Mass Casualty, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Was the gun attack in Las Vegas an act of terrorism? Maybe that's the wrong question.
At some stage, you look at the data and you say, what all of these cases tend to have in common is the access of people with bad motives, whether it's terrorism or insanity or whatever else, to get weapons of mass casualty.
It is something the whole world asks about.
People are completely baffled by America's relationship to guns.
Also on The World, Trump tells his own Secretary of State that talking with North Korea is pointless.
I've covered every Secretary of State since Henry Kissinger, and I've never seen a president treat a Secretary of State with such disregard, dismissively.
All of that and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Thank you for being with us on this Monday. It has been a day where you find yourself catching your breath. Our heads are still reeling from the pain of Puerto Ricans trying to get their lives back together. And then we hear about a mass shooting, the worst in modern American history. We'll get to both stories here at the top of the show and in the second half of The World today, news from the wannabe breakaway state of Catalonia in Spain. But first, as we try to grapple with the deaths in Las Vegas, we turn to Juliet Kayyem. She's a former assistant secretary at the Department of Homeland Security. I started by asking her if she considers the attack terrorism, but she wanted to move beyond that question.
We get stuck on this word terrorism because we're in search of some ideological motivation, which may or may not be forthcoming at this stage. We certainly don't know much about Mr. Paddock, the man responsible for this crime, a man in his 60s who apparently most recently lived at a senior citizen home. But we shouldn't get too focused on this word terrorism and motivation and really focus on the how do we minimize the risks in the future. It is not common for national security and counterterrorism people like me to talk about guns. But at some stage, you look at the data and you say what all of these cases tend to have in common is the access of people with bad motives, whether it's terrorism or insanity or whatever else, to get weapons of mass casualty, right? That's what has happened. That is the way we should look at this because motivations are, you know, there's not going to be a eureka moment where we have some understanding of what leads someone to something like this. And there may be claims of responsibility by other organizations, including ISIS, but we really have to determine based on the facts out there.
Are there legal reasons not to refer to this event as terrorism?
There are. I mean, look, a terrorism charge from a prosecutor's perspective is harder because you actually do have to prove motivation or ties to a terrorist organization. And so it may be that we don't want to tie future prosecutors' hands, especially if Mr. Paddock had co-conspirators in this action. It looks like there might be at least one.
Yeah, I mean, the oft-repeated idea that more people with guns would have helped, that really doesn't seem to be the case here, where the shooter is more than 30 stories high in a building.
Exactly. And look, there were a lot of guns. There were police officials on the ground. My guess is, just given Nevada laws, there were probably a lot of armed individuals at the concert. The problem, of course, as you say, is that he was elevated. And what we are coming to understand, although as you and I know, the facts do change, is that the way they figured out what room it was by fire alarms going off because of how much gunpowder there was. And so it's just time for us to, you know, and I've been saying this a while now, you know, it's time for us to stop hoping for some magic moment of understanding motivation and now looking at terrorism based on the consequences of the crime and the accessibility to weapons of mass casualty.
Yeah, but still, don't we have this perception that as soon as the word terrorism is wheeled out there, many people still think Islam? And now this claim by ISIS, true or not, that he was a soldier who converted, doesn't that muddy what to call this act of violence and muddy how people talk about it?
It does, and it shouldn't, because we, especially in the West, sort of got this warped view of terrorism after 9/11, that it had to be tied to some sort of Islamic terrorist organization. When you actually look at the numbers, especially in the U.S., you know, white supremacy actually ends up being the form of terrorism that kills more individuals. But I'll tell you this, what links the Islamic terrorists and the white supremacists is not an ideology, but is accessibility to weapons of mass casualty.
Juliet Kayyem, former Assistant Secretary at the Department of Homeland Security. Thank you, as always.
Thank you.
America's relationship with guns is truly exceptional. First, there are the numbers. Gun ownership in the U.S. far surpasses any other country, and gun-related homicides in the U.S. are higher than in any other wealthy country. There's also gun culture. I was about to say a moment ago that gun ownership is greater than any country by a long shot, but I thought better of it. It shows you, though, that guns are even a part of our language. Max Fisher is a reporter with the New York Times. He says the gun phenomenon here in the U.S. can be hard for non-Americans to understand.
This is something that I hear all the time when I travel. You know, you go to someplace in Asia, Europe, Latin America, and you're kind of meeting with people. And the one thing they always ask about the United States is, what is it with you guys and guns? And, you know, it's not just
the gun ownership rate, which we certainly stand out on. We have by far the highest per capita gun ownership rate in the world. But it's really our culture around guns and the way that we think about them. I mean, if you look at Switzerland is the example that you often hear, especially from people who are proponents of liberal gun access laws in the United States. They say, well, Switzerland has a high gun ownership rate. And it does. It's still a fraction of that of the United States. The gun ownership rate in the United States is 89 guns per 100 people, so almost one gun per person. And then Switzerland is 45 guns per 100 people. It's about half of the United States rate. Its gun homicide rate is still very unusually high, which is unsurprising because gun ownership rates and gun homicide rates track. But even still, there is a really significant difference between Switzerland and American gun laws and culture. Our laws start with the assumption of universal access to guns, and then you have narrowing from there. There are certain restrictions in when and how and where you can buy them. But in Switzerland, like virtually every other country on earth, you start with the assumption that you should not have access to guns, and then you open up exceptions to that.
Do other countries also scratch their collective heads about how we always seem to avoid talking about the role firearms play in this violence when one of these horrible events occurs?
Yeah, I have never met someone outside the United States who understands it. I mean, it kind of reminds me as an American of the way that we sometimes talk about, you know, gender restrictions in Saudi Arabia or tribal conflict in sub-Saharan Africa. It seems to us as this kind of like very exotic, strange, far-off thing. And that's how people talk about our gun laws.
Is there a country that you can point to where you've seen like a deliberate tightening of the national stock of weapons and it's kind of worked?
Yeah, I mean, the most famous example is Australia, which used to have unusually liberal gun laws. And then after a mass shooting in, I believe, 1996, they had a really extensive buyback program. And the assessment of the success of this is mixed. It did significantly curtail mass shootings. Because there are still a large number of guns in Australia, relatively speaking, there is still a proportional amount of gun crime. Suicides, interestingly, dropped substantially, which I think is a reminder of the way that we think about guns in the United States is very narrow. You hear this expression, the only way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun.
Right.
We think of guns very narrowly in this context of like Jack Bauer, like 24, you know, there's a bad guy out there and how are we going to stop him? But a huge number of gun deaths in the United States are suicide and accidental discharge. And when you remove guns from the equation, or when you reduce the number of guns in the equation, those drop substantially. It's something like the rate of deaths in the United States by accidental gun discharge is, I think, about 20 times the overall gun death rate in Japan.
You know, the rhetorical question I've been seeing repeated again and again is, what is it going to take to have a national discussion about this? So what led to a national discussion in Australia?
There was a mass shooting that killed 35 people, and this just so shocked the country that people kind of asked, well, why do we have these things? And I think that's the difference. You know, I think there's a lot of gun control advocates in the United States who keep waiting for something that's going to shock people. But if that was going to happen, that would have already happened with Sandy Hook, deaths of large numbers of children. But that, again, really highlights how the United States is unique, which is that for a very large segment of the population, access to guns is not just about hunting. It's not just about home defense. It's a core identity issue. It's part of who you are as a person, your political identity, how you orient yourself in society. And that, especially in the last 20 or 30 years, has really been baked into the political culture.
That was the New York Times' Max Fisher. Shifting gears now, immigration is one of the things we focus on here on the world as we draw the connections between out there and here at home. No doubt you've heard that Trump is planning to do away with DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. The White House made that announcement last month. And it's up to Congress now to come up with a way to provide legal protection for the hundreds of thousands of DACA recipients who came to the U.S. as children, or else those DACA recipients will start getting deported. Emma Jacobs spoke with some younger DACA recipients about how the uncertainty is affecting them. And just a heads up, in some cases, we're using first names only because they're undocumented.
Even though he had a sense the decision was coming, Jonathan was shaken when he learned the Trump administration was ending the DACA program. Jonathan is a high school senior in northern New Jersey. He's had DACA protection for the past 2 years. He has a younger brother born in the U.S. who's just 8.
We share a room, so I showed him the news and he asked me about it, and it was difficult to talk about. And I remember going to sleep like at 2 a.m. trying to explain to him what exactly was going on and like his vocabulary.
Jonathan says he has no memories of El Salvador, a country he left as a toddler. And though he knew DACA was something he would have to renew every few years, it made him feel like he had a future here.
I remember having like a little planner and planning out, oh, this is what I'm going to do this week. So I was on track to college. I'm kind of in the limbo.
He's been following the developments in the news really closely. So has Martina, her middle name, whose application for DACA is currently pending. She's been in the U.S. for 16 of her 17 years. She goes to high school in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, with few other immigrants.
I've actually gone to school and talked to my counselors about it. I can't really talk about it with, like, other students because most of them have, like, they were born here. They're U.S. citizens. They don't think about this whole immigrant stuff.
Though when they do, it can add a whole new level to the usual high school stress.
This girl I considered one of, like, my closest friends. She went behind my back, and she was talking smack. And so she told other people that she was going to call ICE on me and my family.
This is a part of the state that voted heavily for President Trump. She sees a lot of yard signs and sometimes Confederate flags. The atmosphere is a little different in the bluer city of Lancaster, which has a larger immigrant community. Roger Avila Vidal, another DACA recipient, leads the Latino club at his high school. He was at school when he read about the official announcement ending DACA, and he was extremely relieved by one of the details it contained, that DACA recipients whose status expires before March 5th could reapply by October 5th for a final extension.
I was lucky because mine expires on March 1st, so I was only like there by 4 days that I could have not been eligible for it. So as soon as I found out, I'm like, oh my gosh, like God is giving me the small chance to be able to do this. So as soon as I got home, I started making sure that I had the same paperwork that I kept inside the same folder. It's in the perfect order that I need it to be.
Because he's reapplying earlier than planned, his parents are hurrying to get together the rest of the $500 fee. He's also applying for college this fall. It's strange, he says, to be filling out applications as an international student, which many colleges require for DACA recipients.
It's odd because I'm sitting here in Lancaster in the United States where there's Amish buggies going around and thinking, wow, I'm living apparently outside of the United States.
And while he'll start college with DACA, he doesn't know what his options will be by the time he graduates.
I'm hoping that something comes along to save those and extend those 2 years to maybe hopefully life. And thinking the idea that, like, as soon as I graduate from college and they have nothing there in place, it's like, okay, that's it. You graduate from college, congratulations, but you're not going to get anything else from the United States.
Roger says he always knew he might confront this someday, that DACA could end. But he usually tried to push it to the back of his mind. Only now, these worries are unavoidable. For The World, Emma Jacobs, Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
I like words.
A podcast.
Crunchy, crackly words.
About language.
Trixie, Tucker, Gentile.
The world in words.
Oh, heavens, my gracious landsake words.
The world in words.
Get it on Apple Podcasts.
Or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. You're tuned to The World. President Donald Trump hasn't always been dead set against talks with North Korea. Just last May, he announced he was willing to meet with Kim Jong-un under the right circumstances. Now, though, not so much. Yesterday, Trump tweeted, "I told Rex Tillerson, our wonderful Secretary of State, that he is wasting his time trying to negotiate with Little Rocket Man," Trump using his nickname for North Korean leader Kim Jong-un there. In the past, though, U.S. diplomats have worked toward the possibility of a meeting between U.S. and North Korean heads of state. New Yorker writer Robin Wright once accompanied a former U.S. Secretary of State on a rare visit to North Korea.
Madeleine Albright was trying to organize an agreement with the North Koreans about its missile program, potentially paving the way for a trip by President Clinton. There was this scramble at the end of the administration to either do a deal on the Middle East with Arafat or with the North Koreans. And Madeleine Albright went on an exploratory mission.
It seems the North Koreans really wanted to make a big impact. What sort of spectacle was arranged?
Oh, it was quite extraordinary. You had over 100,000 North Koreans out in this massive stadium performing with synchronized cards and dancing and gymnasts. It was the Olympics, but just in North Korea. There were fireworks, and it was very interesting. They had all these cards, and the whole stadium would show different designs. They would flash them simultaneously.
These kind of like human pixels. They'd hold up these cards and change the picture.
And one of them, of course, pointedly, was of a missile.
And this is happening all in the middle of the night somewhere out in the countryside. How did you read? How did the people with Albright read this display, especially that missile at the end? Was it threatening or was it what you expected?
It was nationalist.
Yeah.
It was a sign that the North Koreans believed this was an important part of their defense system and that probably that this was going to be some tough negotiation.
And we should point out, too, this was happening in the middle of one of North Korea's infamous famines as well, right?
It was. And one of the things that was really striking as I walked the streets was to see the carts carrying produce in from the countryside. And there were kernels of corn that fell on the ground and people would scramble from the streets to pick them up.
Wow. So here we are today in 2017, another weekend of some disturbing tweets and news about North Korea. That diplomatic effort back in 2000 ultimately collapsed. What would you say today are the lessons from that whole foray?
Well, I think that the North Koreans are interested in diplomacy, but I also think it was a lesson that they're not prepared to give up their nuclear weapons. They believe this is their ultimate deterrent from attack. And I don't think they intend to use it. It's a little bit like the Iranians, but they feel that they have to have something to ensure that anyone who attacks them knows that they will pay a heavy price. This is a paranoid, introverted, cult-led country. They really genuinely believe that the West, the United States particularly, is out to get them. And this is a country that doesn't have many friends in the world, and the Chinese are not always the best allies either.
So that message from Pyongyang is pretty consistent. And then you turn to Washington. We had this weekend Rex Tillerson asked by the New York Times about the possibility of direct diplomatic engagement with Kim Jong-un. And he says, "We are probing, so stay tuned." Then President Trump tweets Sunday morning, "I told Rex Tillerson, our wonderful Secretary of State, that he is wasting his time trying to negotiate with Little Rocket Man," apparently undercutting Tillerson's efforts. So how are you making sense of what's going on here?
Well, first, I've covered every Secretary of State since Henry Kissinger, and I've never seen a president treat a Secretary of State with such disregard, dismissively. Diplomacy is what the Secretary of State engages in. It's what prevents war, and it is critical at this juncture. I did a story about what war with North Korea would look like, and the estimates are staggering. You know, 100,000 dead in Seoul, over 1 million casualties in South Korea alone. We would have to engage in probably regime change to eliminate the threat of a nuclear weapon as well as the nuclear weapons themselves. And the danger is we could probably win the first war and oust the regime. It'd be like Iraq, though. Then you have to create an alternative. And there will be millions in North Korea who believe that they must defend themselves, and the prospect of an insurgency, long-term insurgency, like Iraq, like Afghanistan. So the idea that you can dismiss diplomacy before it's even begun sends a signal to the North Koreans. And one of the things that I really worry about is whether the North Koreans, believing they may lose this stuff, that the kind of tensions that are escalating in a war of words, that they decide to do something silly or provocative that then both sides feel they are effectively in a real war, not just a war of words.
How do you think Trump actually envisions diplomacy when it comes to this really high stakes subject matter?
Well, I think he believes in taking a very tough line and often kind of saying, this is it. And if you don't agree, forget it. There's one episode in 1989, shortly after his book, The Art of the Deal, came out, that he lobbied very hard with the first Bush administration to become the negotiator with the Soviet Union. He really wanted the job, and he thought that that would prove that he could do the art of the deal any place. He did not get the job, but he did have an encounter with the man who did, ambassador to West Germany, Richard Byrd. And Trump said to him, well, let me tell you how I would have done it if I'd been appointed the negotiator with the Soviet Union. I would have gotten them all comfortable around a table. I would have stood up and shouted, bleep you, and got up, turned around, and walked off. And that has always been illustrative to me of how he approaches diplomacy, not engaging, but basically saying, this is it or nothing.
Do you know how Rex Tillerson is feeling about all of this as the U.S. chief diplomat and essentially being told, no, diplomacy doesn't really matter right now?
Well, you have to wonder how the national security apparatus in Washington really feels about this. The fact is that the Pentagon doesn't want a war with North Korea. You have to believe that H.R. McMaster, the national security advisor, doesn't want a war. These are guys who are generals. They fought wars, and they know how costly and long they can be, the unintended consequences.
And now we learn from reliable sources that President Trump has specifically instructed top officials to portray him to foreign counterparts as crazy, willing to make rash moves. How do you think the North Koreans are likely to interpret that?
Well, I think they already believe that he's unpredictable, and they worry a lot about that. There's a diplomacy adds the element of stability, even at moments of tension, even while nuclear tests are being conducted. There is a sense that there is a way out. And I think the only way out at the moment, because war is not going to be the solution, is the freeze of the program so that it doesn't do any more tests and that you then try to contain North Korea.
So, Robin, you write how Wendy Sherman, who was the State Department's policy coordinator on North Korea under President Clinton, she told you the North Koreans are not crazy in the sense that we use the word in the vernacular. What did she mean?
I think she believes that they will engage diplomatically and rationally in their own self-interests. Kim Jong-un is not irrational. You can disagree with what he's doing, developing a nuclear program, relying on a communist regime that fails to provide for its people, that starves its people, that he's engaged in the killing of his own relatives to consolidate power. Clearly, he is a bad leader in every respect. But the question is, what is the alternative? And can we engage with them? And the fact that his father engaged with Madeleine Albright, I think, is an important indicator that he might too.
New Yorker author and journalist Robin Ryan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
What would the news sound like if media were diverse?
Things get racialized here. Muslim is this weird racial thing here, and I don't think our parents were prepared for that.
I'm Rupa Shenoy, host of the podcast Otherhood. Listen to What You're Missing on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. U.S. diplomats in Cuba have been getting sick, losing their hearing, headaches, vomiting. There's speculation that a high-tech sonic weapon could be the cause. Really?
More than likely, this was a beta test of a new technology that went bad, and it was unintentional damage. Something that should just kind of bend. Let's make them throw up.
Real-life spy stuff in Havana. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Day 12, and there is still no electricity on much of the island of Puerto Rico. The slow pace of federal help has other officials taking matters into their own hands and trying to pitch in. Here in Massachusetts, local lawmakers and community organizers have launched a fundraising effort to raise money for aid. Massachusetts State Representative Jeffrey Sanchez is the honorary vice chair of the campaign. For him, what happened in Puerto Rico is personal. He has family there, including a cousin who just recently made it to Boston.
Thank God on Friday, my cousin who had a flight canceled from JetBlue essentially went from line to line to line and ended up on a Southwest flight flying into Miami to Atlanta to Chicago, to Boston, when we picked her up, which was incredible and emotional. And it was something else. And she looked like she had gone through hell, and she was back. And she collapsed in her daughter's arms. It was very dramatic.
Wow.
And at the same time, she was suffering because her parents, my aunt and uncle, are still there. And then we have another aunt that we haven't been able to engage, and she's the one we're worried about because she lives in an isolated area in the town of Sidra, you know, on the side of a mountain, and we're just concerned because, again, the island is really suffering. People are drinking water off the top of their roofs.
I mean, what you say, it is incredible, it is emotional, but it's not exceptional. I'm hearing lots of stories like these in the midst of the chaos at the airport, people trying to get out. I mean, she's not the only one, your cousin.
People are trapped. Yeah. People are trapped, and it's unlike anything. Again, it's like what you see in those kids, you know, video games, Area 51, people trying to evacuate, you know, mayday, mayday. And unfortunately, there's a sense in the small towns and in the hamlets that nobody cares, nobody's listening because nobody can get to them.
As a state lawmaker, what is the pressure you're feeling to do something more? Because as we've seen, there have been a lot of people criticizing Washington for not doing enough.
I think people like myself in local office, I'm not the only one. I hear it from my colleagues across the country that they're feeling pressure from the local constituencies to say, what are you doing to organize a community and also to make connections with the powers that be in the governor's office, in the mayor's offices, and frankly, in Washington, D.C., well, with the president himself.
You were appointed to a working group by the Massachusetts Speaker of the State House to, quote, monitor the unprecedented actions of the Trump administration earlier this year. Where would you rank the Trump administration's reaction to post-Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico in terms of unprecedented?
First and foremost, I think the governor of Puerto Rico, Governor Rosselló, is correct in that nothing like this has ever been seen. And those folks that work for FEMA, the military that's out there right now, they're busting their backs. We can see it. But there's something wrong. There's something wrong. And I think that we heard it in the cries of the mayor of San Juan asking for help and asking for attention. This is Katrina size. Maria is Katrina size or bigger. This is Donald Trump's Katrina. Puerto Rico and Maria is Donald Trump's Katrina.
Presumably, you've been to Puerto Rico before.
My entire life. Yeah. Please.
What do you love about your home?
You know what? The island is a very inspirational place because of its people, the culture. We're a melting pot from Africa, from Spain, from Corsica. There's just so much, and it's so little that people hear of the island. That's why I hope when Donald Trump lands in San Juan tomorrow that he can look beyond the tarmac. It's an incredible place with hardworking, committed people that have love for their brethren. Right now, I saw a clip that showed people that were clearing up trees, and they said, when the government gets here, it'll be done. And they're tying trees to bumpers to try and get the trees out of the main ways. The resilience of the Puerto Rican people is extremely inspirational, and we're seeing that right now. So amidst the crying and amidst the disaster, there's an incredible spirit of life that's happening amongst everyone on that island right now. And frankly, it's exploding out here to the United States. There's a connection that's happening right now that I can't think in my entire lifetime where I've heard Puerto Rico mentioned in so many days. So maybe this tragedy, maybe Maria's tragedy, will bring big and positive outcomes to the island.
And given that Massachusetts has the fifth largest number of Puerto Ricans among U.S. states, has the response been what you were hoping for?
It's been what I was hoping for and better. But again, we in the government, from local and frankly to federal, should figure out how is it that help that we have accumulated will get to the people who need it the most.
Jeffrey Sanchez, state representative here in Massachusetts. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you, Marco.
And now an update on the situation in the Spanish region of Catalonia. As you've heard, many people there went to the polls yesterday to vote in that referendum on Catalan independence from Spain. The Spanish federal government tried to prevent that vote. You may have seen what happened. This is from a video taken at a polling station in Barcelona yesterday, a school. Reporter Jerry Haddon has kids who attend this school, and Jerry was there when all of this went down. So last time we were talking, Jerry, on air, I asked you if you thought there would be violence with this referendum yesterday. Tell us what we're listening to.
That was the sound of national police just as they were beginning to physically remove people from the main entrance on the street to our kids' school, folks with locked arms who were trying to protect the ballot boxes that were inside. And within just a couple of moments, as people resisted, the police were beating on folks with their batons, throwing them to the ground, and, you know, just seemed hell-bent on moving through the people as fast as possible to get to the door.
Was anybody hurt?
One woman was taken away in an ambulance. She was punched in the back of the head. I caught that on video and fell pretty hard to the sidewalk. Afterwards, many, many people had contusions, cuts, and bruises and so forth, but I don't think any of the parents and the neighbors that I know who were there ended up in the hospital. The regional health authority says about 850 people ended up checking into a clinic in some place or another.
So things around yesterday's referendum seemed to kind of culminate with this violence. But I know you were at this polling station hours ahead of the vote. Just walk us through the day and what you saw.
Initially, you know, there were people guarding the door at night, and there was a sense of nervousness, but also people kept saying this is going to be an historic day for Catalans. Then at 9 a.m., the polling place officially opened. And just about the same time, everyone's social media accounts started buzzing with videos being sent in from parents at other schools showing violent tactics by the national police, throwing people downstairs, dragging people out by their hair. In one image, there's a woman, somehow a policeman got his fingers into her mouth, and he's literally dragging her sort of by her top teeth backwards across the sidewalk. Really horrifying stuff to look at. So the mood changed rapidly at our school to one of fear and tension, because most people assumed that at some point or another, the police were going to show up at that door as well.
Do we know even the result of the vote at this point with all this police interference?
I think the police were able to enter into 92 different polling places and confiscate the ballot boxes. But last night, the top Catalan leadership held a press conference on television, and they claimed that just over 2 million people ended up being able to vote and whose votes had actually been counted as of last night. That would be about 40 to 45% of the total voting population. They say 90% of those votes cast were in favor of independence. Critics of the highly irregular vote, of course, argue that, well, the people who were against this vote to begin with, who didn't think it was legal, didn't turn out to vote. So, of course, it was skewed in favor of independence.
Well, yesterday you tweeted this. Let me just read this tweet, Jerry. One voter in Catalonia just said to me that no matter how the independence vote goes today, given the violent government crackdown, Spain has lost us forever. So where does this leave Catalonia's hopes for independence?
Well, you know, they're in a very tough position still in terms of negotiating some kind of settlement with Madrid. Where do you find the goodwill today to even sit down at the negotiating table after what went down yesterday from the Catalan side? And, you know, Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy, he came out last night in his own press statement on television saying, listen, I followed the law and I will continue to follow the law. And it's up to the Catalan separatists to desist. If the Catalans want to sit down and talk about better conditions with inside Spain, he says he's willing to do that, but he will not touch the idea of independence or reforming the Constitution in order for such a vote to take place.
Jerry, did your kids go back to the school today where there was a polling station yesterday? And what have you heard from them?
At the elementary school where all this went down yesterday, in the morning, there was a moment of silence in the big playground just above where all the heavy-handedness took place. And then everyone sang the John Lennon song, Imagine. And there was a lot of crying among parents and hugging and so on and so forth. There wasn't a discussion, a political discussion, you know, in front of the kids. There was just that moment of reflection. And then class started. There's a general strike that begins tomorrow and could last for up to 10 days in Catalonia. And that includes schools. So we've received today messages both from the elementary school and from our daughter's high school that essentially they could come to school tomorrow, but there won't be classes, there won't be activities, there won't be cafeteria. They'd just be sitting around in the hallways.
Reporter Jerry Haddon in Barcelona. Thanks for being with us again, Jerry.
You bet, Marco.
We have video of the scenes of police violence at a Barcelona polling place. That's up on the world's Facebook page at facebook.com/PRI the world. President Trump's new travel restrictions go into effect later this month. The latest set of rules apply to travelers from 8 countries. They may have to undergo tougher screening and vetting requirements or could be banned from traveling to the U.S. altogether. Previous versions of Trump's policy have sparked protests and heated debate this year, but the kind of restrictions at the center of it all can be traced back as far as the 19th century.
At the end of the 19th century, there was the biggest global migration in history, essentially. And the United States was one of the major destinations because it was an industrialized nation.
Maddalena Marinari is assistant professor of history at Gustavus Adolphus College in Minnesota. She says when immigrants from Italy, Eastern Europe, and China started to move into the country in big numbers, the U.S. government responded with new rules.
The very first restrictions were against Chinese, and so almost all Chinese were excluded from 1882 to 1943. And so once legislators took care of the yellow threat, as they called it, they switched their attention to Italians and Eastern European Jews. So up until 1882, there are virtually no regulations, but then there is a series of legislation that start defining who is a desirable immigrant. And so, for example, class became an issue, disability, if you committed a previous crime, all these things that now we know and we take for granted as part of the immigration system were created specifically targeting these immigrants at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. By 1917, we have a literacy test, which everyone thought would stop Italians in particular from coming in.
But it
didn't work because this test took a while to pass. It took about 20 years. Literacy rates actually went up in Italy because that's a way that the Italian government was trying to respond to this formal restriction.
So it
did not work.
it's fascinating. So the Italian government actually kind of got their head around these literacy tests and helped their people to prepare for them, essentially. Is that what you're saying?
Right. So the Italian government was, and it was not the only one, but the Italian government was probably the most proactive. The moment the U.S. Congress started debating restrictions targeting Southern and Eastern Europeans, they immediately passed a new immigration law. They passed stricter requirements to apply for some of this documentation that the United States required for immigrants to come in. They provided education. So Italy was truly committed to trying to fulfill the requirements the United States had. And in the end, it actually didn't work. Mm. Not only the harder the Italian government tried, the more restrictionist politicians said, see, they're interjecting with our political system. They only have their immigrants' priorities in mind. Hence, they need to be restricted. And in fact, despite the efforts of the Italian government, it didn't work. By 1924, the United States passed a really strict immigration law that introduced a quota system that heavily penalized Italians. And so it actually reduced the immigration from Italy to a trickle.
Maddalena, I got to confess, I'm a bit of a history nerd, and I read a book a few years back about a young Italian immigrant named Maria Barbella. You may know the story. She'd killed a man who'd raped her and ended up being sentenced to death. She'd have been the first woman, in fact, sent to the then newly invented electric chair, but miraculously a noblewoman threaded the needle of double jeopardy, got her retried and freed. But that whole story suggested to me a different treatment of immigrants, even a different set of laws for some immigrants at the turn of the century. And Italians at the time just seemed, frankly, slightly better than blacks from the South. Does that accurately lay out what was going on?
Definitely. White immigrants, Italian immigrants, definitely were not as discriminated as immigrants of color, for example, or African Americans in the South. But what's interesting in this case is how they were trying to regulate, restrict Italian immigration echoed a lot of the same measures. So, for example, the literacy test that was borrowed from the South, where they were using the literacy test to disenfranchise African Americans from voting, essentially. Mm-hmm. So there is a lot of overlap. But once they were in the U.S., I think they did fare better than other minorities.
So you're a historian. You spent a lot of time looking back at all these policies. Today, what lessons are you taking away? What occurs to you?
Well, historically, a lot of these provisions were laws. But what worries me about the ban is that these are executive orders. And so in a way, they're a lot more unpredictable and unstable because every new administration could keep changing their provisions, essentially.
Maddalena Marinari teaches history at Gustavus Adolphus College. She's written about all of this for us. You can find it at our website, pri.org. I got to say, this is strange stuff, this next story. At least 20 people associated with the U.S. Diplomatic Corps in Cuba have been suffering from hearing loss, dizziness, nausea, and even concussions and brain swelling. It's been going on since November last year, and it's affected some in Canada's diplomatic community there, too. On Friday, the Trump administration cut the U.S. diplomatic presence in Havana in half and warned Americans not to go there. There's talk that it's some kind of secret sonic weapon that's been making people sick. Cuba vehemently denies doing anything like that, and there is no evidence of it at this point. So what is going on? Our reporter Sarah Birnbaum tries to find out more.
Okay, full disclosure. To me, this sounds absolutely crazy. But it doesn't sound weird to Vince Houghton, the curator of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C.
It's a long pastime of intelligence agencies to mess with diplomats of other countries, particularly adversary countries.
Let's go back to the Cold War.
Operation Mongoose was the program that was created after the failure of Bay of Pigs, and this was the CIA's attempt to try to take Castro out through various methods. Castro was an avid scuba diver, so one of the ideas was to create an exploding seashell that would be put on a reef near where Castro liked to scuba dive, and it would be so beautiful that Castro would feel compelled to go pick it up and look at it, and then it would blow up and kill them. There are other ideas about he gave a radio address every week, and the idea was let's lace the radio studio with LSD. So when Castro gave his radio address, he would be tripping on acid and give a really wacky radio address, and then no one would want to follow him anymore.
And this one is my personal favorite.
One of the ideas was to sprinkle his shoes with thallium salts, which causes your hair to fall out. So the idea would be that Castro's beard would fall out, and then because the Cuban people were so machismo, they would no longer want to follow him because he didn't have his beard.
That one would have totally worked. But if we're talking about sonic weapons that cause lasting damage, maybe a closer corollary is the spy dust from the Cold War. The Stasi, the East German secret police, would use radioactive chemicals to track suspected dissidents. Anna Funder is the author of the book Stasiland.
So they developed basically radioactive tags, including irradiated pins that they could surreptitiously insert into a person's clothing, radioactive magnets on cars, and radioactive pellets into tires.
Funder also says the Stasi would break into homes and spray the floor with scandium-46. And when people walked through, the radioactive chemical would stick to their shoes, and then they would leave radioactive footprints wherever they went. And then the Stasi would follow them through the crowds with Geiger counters tucked in their armpits. So given all of this, sonic weapons are starting to seem not so far-fetched, but not so fast.
This kind of a weapon would be extraordinarily expensive to develop.
Vince Houghton, the international spy guy, says something doesn't quite add up.
The Cuban intelligence agency, they are very, very good, but they don't have a ton of resources. So they don't have a massive budget to do this kind of thing.
But wait for it.
Now, that being said, they have very rich friends, meaning the Russians, who could potentially be beta testing this inside Cuba.
Houghton says the Cubans probably didn't intend for the weapon to cause permanent brain damage, because that would be a deliberate ratcheting up of tensions, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense, diplomatically speaking.
More than likely, this was a beta test of a new technology that went bad, and it was unintentional damage being done of something that should just kind of been, let's make them throw up, let's make them dizzy, and then, it went way too far.
I don't think that's the case here, though. I don't think that's realistic at all.
This naysayer is Dr. Joe Pompei, an acoustics expert in Boston.
I'm saying the technology is not remotely feasible for audio waves or sound waves to be causing the set of symptoms that's been reported.
In order for sound to alter your brain chemistry, the sonic alarm has to be applied directly to your head.
You can't do it through the phone. You can't do it through the walls or the windows or the roof or the ceilings. The best case, I think the most realistic case if something like this were to happen, somebody would have to be in a large bathtub covered in ultrasonic transducers at very high power, very high strength, and have that ultrasound focused very carefully to their head and have to submerge their head underwater and have all these drivers going on at the same time.
And they probably would have reported that. So where does that leave us? There are other theories floating around, like it could be a virus or poison or radiation, or maybe it's a technology no one's ever seen before.
I mean, of course, we have no proof of any of this, but it's fun to speculate.
Yeah, and kind of scary, too. For the world, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
You'd be forgiven if you were feeling a little out of whack these days, especially today. A lot of us are, since it seems that things are out of whack just about everywhere we look. But for some of us, it actually might not be politics or global conflict or senseless violence. It might just be our body clocks. People have known for a while that our bodies have some sort of mechanism for synchronizing our own rhythms with the daily rhythm of the sun rising and setting, and that it can be thrown off by things like having to work a night shift or getting an early morning wake-up call. Well, beginning back in the 1980s, three American scientists unraveled the secrets of our internal body clocks. And this morning, ironically, they all got early morning wake-up calls from the Karolinska Institute in Sweden.
Skall delas lika mellan Jeffrey C. Hall, Michael Rosbach och Michael W. Young.
That's the secretary of the Institute's Nobel Assembly making the announcement today that Jeffrey C. Hall, Michael Rosbach, and Michael W. Young have been awarded this year's Nobel Prize in Medicine for their work on chronobiology, the study of biological clocks. And it's not just humans that have these internal clocks. In fact, the three scientists first isolated a gene that controls daily biological rhythms in fruit flies. Further research revealed a complex system influenced by a number of genes, and that is pretty much found among all known life forms. Not surprising, perhaps, since we've all shared the same basic rhythm of night and day since the beginning of life on Earth. It's come to be known as the circadian rhythm. Here's that guy we heard a minute ago, Nobel Assembly Secretary Thomas Perlman.
Ever since the emergence of life on Earth, about 4 billion years ago, evolving life forms had to adapt to the rotation of our planet. This ability to prepare for the regular daily fluctuations is crucial for all life forms. This year's Nobel laureates solved the mystery of how an inner clock in most of our cells in our bodies can anticipate daily fluctuations between night and day to optimize our behavior and physiology.
The research has also helped illuminate how those body clocks of ours can get out of whack, especially in advanced species like our own, in which work and family and travel don't always line up with those basic rhythms of life. But it's also helped us figure out how we can get ourselves back in sync, at least when it comes to sleep. Those other things that seem out of sync, well, maybe someday someone will win a Nobel for helping us understand and fix them. Keep that hope alive. That'll do it for us today from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.